A very busy March 9th edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC. Jack Devine, former high-ranking CIA official, talked to us in the 3 o'clock hour about his new book illustrating the CIA's history battling the Russians. Gambling expert Ken Adams joined us from Reno, Nevada in the 4 o'clock hour to talk about do's and don'ts for Connecticut as the state gets closer to legal sports betting. Jim Cameron, commuter writer for Hearst Connecticut Media, joined us in the 5 o'clock hour to talk about his latest column. And my producer, Eric, got into it a little bit with Melissa regarding Disney and Universal and all that. International intrigue, which you know I love to do, and we talked about this very subject with a couple of previous guests, especially in light of the solar winds hack. What is up with Moscow, Russia, Vladimir Putin, with a new administration after the Trump 4 years? Well, joining us right now is an expert on that and more. Jack Devine is on the line. Jack heads and is president of the Arkin Group, an international risk consulting and intelligence firm. But, folks, he formerly served as acting director and associate director of operation at the CIA. Our guest was in charge of the CIA's largest and most successful covert action operation, which drove the Russians out of Afghanistan. You remember that? Yeah. The name of his new book, Spymaster's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. Jack Devine, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Good. Nice to speak to you, Paul.
Thank you, Jack. Great to have you on. I love this topic. I love delving into it. Boy, Jack, Russian aggression. Those two words go together, don't they? They've been going together since what? The middle and the end of World War II, right?
Well, that's the premise of my book. I mean, I think a lot of us felt that at the when the wall came down and the Cold War seemed to end, there was a breather and people felt, well, you know, what do we have to worry about Russia? Well, the truth of the matter is, and I go through the book with former spy cases and current spy cases, bring it up to the current Trump and Biden era, but I can tell you definitively that they kept operating and they ran the spy Robert Hansen inside the FBI at the same time that the Soviet Union was falling apart. So they have been persistent and creative, and they're very, very aggressive inside of the United States.
So, Jack, is there this core then that is still breathing, is still undulating there, pulsating ever since previous to, say, the Khrushchev days, through him, through the Cold War? Is there a core of espionage aimed at the U.S., Jack, that just is never going to end?
In the book, at the very beginning, I talk about Comrade Jay. Comrade Jay was the number two person in the New York office of the KGB. It's now called the SVR. And he started spying in the for several years, but defected in 2004. So it was a very senior position, aware of all of their activities in the United States and around the world. So when he came out, he said, you know, it was interesting. When I first joined the KGB, we had three major targets, mm-hmm. the United States, NATO, and China. Right? When I left, the same three targets were still at play, United States, NATO, and China. So we remained their number one collection focus. And we've seen their hand. I mean, you mentioned it earlier, Paul, with regard to their hacking activities yeah. in the United States, 2016 in the election. All these are emblematic of the continuing Russian Cold War mentality.
What do the Russians, Jack Devine, or at least their government, I firmly believe that most of this stuff in any nation doesn't really trickle down to people, the working folks every day. But, Jack, what does their government to this day still hate or dislike about the U.S.? Is it our standard of living? Is it capitalism? Is it the fact that, you know, we call the shots? I mean, I've heard, for example, Jack Vladimir Putin say, you know, he doesn't think Russia is respected enough in the world. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it all comes down to Putin and his vision. And I'll leave that word hate aside. I really think it's more strategic mm-hmm. than that.
Yeah.
But Putin is and I go into a chapter, I call it the Spymaster's president, right? And what's interesting, I have a subquote, and it's, there's no such thing as a former KGB officer, says Putin, right? That's his quote, right? I understand it because there's no such thing as a former CIA guy.
Jack, as a friend of mine once said, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. You may be a retired Marine, but you're always a Marine, yeah.
The one way to annoy a Marine is to say that. But the CIA, what I'm really getting at is it's not that you're under payroll, but there's a mindset, a prison. There's a way you look at the world. So what your audience may not realize is that when I was, I was in seven countries, I was chief of five of them. I spent half my career abroad in the struggle with the Russians and other communist states. But when I was dealing with the Russians, they largely were westernized, it was in Rome or in Mexico City or whatever. But he, as a young man, wanted to join the KGB. He was rejected because he was too young. Eventually got in, and he went to East Germany. So East Germany was sort of the darkest place of the Soviet Union. Carla, the famous spy in Le Carré's books, it's based on Marcus Wolf, the head of the East German's intelligence service. And Putin was there at that time, and he was a KGB officer there in this dark world of spying and a hard edge. And his life collapsed. His belief, he was stunned by the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And I think it seared his mindset. And he vowed it was never going to happen again. And then he got into politics, and people underestimate him. When you look at his career and his age, how quick he got to the top. And many of the old bureaucrats running the KGB thought he could be managed. They didn't realize he was the one managing the game. But let me come, because I know it's a radio program, can't go into a dissertation on it. What he's basically adopted is the Cold War strategy. In other words, he was a Cold Warrior. And today, if you look at his strategy, what does he want to do? He wants to keep the United States off balance and weak. It's not to overthrow it with a revolution. He just wants this weak. That's what they've always wanted. He wanted to regain the Ukraine. He wanted to have warm water ports. In other words, this is a strategic thing. It's not visceral in the sense of hating America. And there is no ideological split. So I think it's a real strategy. And I think we have to be more mindful of it when we look at things like the 2016 election. It's not a one-off. It's part of a bigger strategy.
Jack, hang on. This is fascinating stuff. Jack Devine is the guest. The name of the book, Spy Master's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. By the way, the website to find out more about Jack, the Arkin, A-R-K-I-N, the Arkin Group. com. Jack, hang on. More with Jack Devine coming up. First, traffic and weather together on WICC. And I am sure there are a boatload of folks in Ansonia and all around our area who are intrigued by international spy ships, spy masters, the Spy Master's Prism, the Fight Against Russian Aggression. A few more minutes with the author of the book and a gentleman who formerly served as acting director and associate director of operation at the CIA, Jack Devine, who's with us for a few more minutes. Jack, I've always wondered when an opposition agent flips, like when a KGB agent flips, for example, and approaches you guys either at an embassy or a contact or whatever, says, hey, I'm done. I want to stay in the U.S. Here's what I know. I know there's a whole process of making sure you're not getting, railroaded. But when you ask them, Jack Devine, why are you flipping? What do they say? I've always wondered that. What's their reasoning?
I have a good story. I just want to put a footnote. We usually, the first thing we say is, look, go back in and work inside. That's what we want you to do.
Earn your
way out.
But, yeah.
So years ago, there was a famous defector, Nosinko, and he came out and he was, it was about the time of Kennedy's assassination. Mm-hmm. And he came out, he actually was in the KGB and was in charge of surveillance of Oswald. And the KGB eventually said, look, the guy's crazy. We can't handle him. They were glad to see him go back. But I had dinner with him once. It's a very controversial case. I go into it in great detail. But I had dinner with him once in a foreign country. And I sat down and I asked him that very question. And he said, well, first of all, I left my family, my wife, my mother, my children. I left everybody. And I left and I didn't have contact with them because if I had contact with them, they would be, the government would act against them. Oh. So for their sake, he didn't do that. He said it was like And this is the point that I thought was, you know, you got to realize Russians in a glass of vodka get very poetic. It's like reaching in and ripping your heart out.
Wow. You know? Yeah.
So it is a big deal when people leave. And I think, and again, this I could write a thesis on this, but our work was hard, Americans recruiting Russians. But the world wanted to be on our side. I mean, most of the free world wanted to be on our side. Foreign governments wanted to work with us. So we were on friendly turf. Mm. I think selling communism after about, say, 1960 was a hard sell.
That's a tough sell. That's a tough sell, Jack.
You know, so they basically spent more time on subordinating people and, you know, compromising people. They really had very few ideological defections after, let's say, mid-60s. We were in a different position.
In the couple of minutes we have left, let's talk about now the transition, Jack Devine, from the Trump years to the Biden years. I know there are career people in all the agencies, NSA, CIA, FBI, so there's not going to be that much change there. But at the top level of this, the visuals that are soaked up by the Americans and the Russian people, what do you see is the changing dynamic, if any, with the U.S. and Russians and the intelligence agencies in segueing from the Trump years to now the Biden years?
Well, I think you really cast it in the right way. It may sound simple, but a lot of people don't get it, that you actually have a lot of stability in the government. There's experts from different parties that go in. And much of policy is determined by the world. Now, Biden is only going to have so much leeway, and so is Trump. But it's within that leeway that you can be quite controversial. I'm going to quote Comrade Jay. The number three three objectives for the Russians going forward in the next 10 years will be United States, NATO. So the objective will be the same. How we deal with it is another proposition. Mm-hmm. I think there's a very serious problem in the cyber arena. There are no rules of the road. During the Cold War, we had rules. Not rules, understanding. We called them the Moscow rules. We wouldn't counterfeit your money. We wouldn't strong-arm your people. You don't strong-arm. It's not
really. That's interesting.
But today, there are no rules. In other words, they're meddling in our country, and what's our response? So I think one of the challenges for the Biden administration will be to address this issue. How do you get Putin's Russia to agree to some understanding? And it's not just Russia, but Russia is the most aggressive one in the United States in terms of going after our targeting our defense industry, targeting our political. So the only one that's playing around in a major way in our political system. How do you get them to the table? My experience with Russia is that they respect power, and I think it's not going to be jawboning and nice conferences and agreements. There's going to have to be some serious backroom discussions because you can't have it out in a forum. But I think, you know, our seriousness. Ukraine is one of the really hot spots in the world when we look at Russian policy. How are we going to deal with that situation? And I think at the end of the day, it's probably not going to be dramatically different. The basic tenets, the style may be different. One last point.
Sure.
It takes two to tango. I am for a reset. I would like to see Russia in the West and part of it. You know, there's no communism. What's the problem here, as you said at the very beginning? But it's like the tango. It takes two. It takes two. And I think, you know, President Trump wanted to have a reset. It wasn't possible. I think President Biden's going to find the same challenge. It's how do you get Putin to decide? He's an extremely good tactician. In other words, what he's executing is a very effective Cold War strategy. I think it's just a lousy strategy for the 21st century, right? It's like, where do you really want Russia to go? And if it's just sort of maintaining Russia as a power, all hunkered down in the world hates you, well, good luck. It's going to be far less enterprise. I think we're starting to see cracks in the system. He's not vulnerable, although in the age of cyber, things happen quickly. It's not vulnerable. You can see the cracks in the system with Novotny and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's going to be a hard sell for Biden to bring him into a more collaborative relationship.
And we shall watch that. Jack, thank you for the work you've done, and thanks to all the people, many of whom we will never know their names, especially in memoriam, as to what the intelligence groups do, like the CIA, like the NSA, and such. The name of the book, Jack Devine, Spymaster's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. Jack Devine, former acting director and associate director of operations at the CIA. Jack, thank you. Good luck, and hopefully we can talk down the road. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Jack. Jack Devine, name of the book, folks, Spymaster's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. Man, could we talk to him for hours? You know what, folks? The stuff he must know. Seriously. I mean, this guy was an associate director of operations at the CIA. Think about the stuff that he knows that he just can't talk about. Wow. PCGamingReports.com. Analyst Ken Adams is the guest out in Vegas. Hey, Ken, Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm in Reno, but, you know, Vegas is fine. I'll go for the day.
I'm sorry. I looked at the area code. Yeah, I used to work in Vegas for like 6 months way back in the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
And what happens when the lower boss likes you and the big boss doesn't, that's what happened to me. But anyway, I digress.
You digress.
Yeah, I digress. Yeah, enough about me. Hey, Ken, you're obviously watching what's going on here in Connecticut from afar. A lot of you folks are in the industry. What do you make of this so far, the situation we're looking at here, where we've got one tribe on board and the other one is kind of holding out here?
Do you know the details of why the Pequot are holding out?
They don't like some of the math in the deal. They are.
And did you read about that? Did you read how much the money was?
20% tax. They don't like on.
It was the number comes out for them to be, according to the their spokesman, about $500,000,
yeah,
which he says to the state is a rounding number.
Yeah.
To the tribe has become a big number. And you know the history of that tribe when they were making a lot of money and they were distributing to tribal members. The estimates, nobody knows for sure, but the estimates were about $400,000 a year.
Yeah.
Per tribal member.
Yeah.
That all stopped a long time ago, and the tribe has been under extreme financial pressure for the last 10 years. So money's important to them. That's one. Two, they negotiated the first slot machine deal with the state that guaranteed them exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
And they have lived up to their part by, and I don't know what the numbers are, but between the two tribes, the numbers is somewhere in between $5 and $8 billion, I think.
Yeah, it's been, Ken, it's been 25% of the slot.
Yes.
Since the early 90s. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the time that when it got going, that was the largest casino in the world and the most profitable. Everybody was making money from it. If you fast forward to now, the tribe feels probably, I'm not a tribal member, and I'm certainly not a spokesman for the tribe, they probably feel that they aren't being respected at the same level for what they've contributed. They're just a piece in this. Oh, well, just move this and move this, and then we can, then the state can have this.
Yeah.
And I think probably, well, he said, you know, it takes us back to the 17th century Indian Wars, and I'm insulted, is what he said.
Referring to the other tribe, the Mohegans. Now, are you surprised, Ken, in your experience, that you've got one tribe agreeing with the chief executive like the governor and the other still on the outside, or does this happen a lot?
It happens. Every tribe is an individual sovereign entity with its own separate history, culture, language, and worldview. They may share some territory, but they are as different as they are common. They're common to us because they're all Native Americans,
mm-hmm.
but they aren't common to each other. So two quick examples. In Oklahoma, the governor negotiated somewhat same sort of deal with several tribes for sports betting and online gambling, and the rest of the tribes said, whoa, now.
I read about that.
Then they took him to court, and he lost. Right, so that's one. New York also has a history of which tribes agree and which tribes don't agree with the. So right now, the Seneca, in a not dissimilar case, mm-hmm. the Seneca says that you violated this exclusivity with us, and when you did that, we stopped payment. And they've stopped payment now. I don't know how many years it is. It's about 7 or 8 years, I think.
Wow.
They stopped payment. Well, they just lost in court the last round. They haven't started the payments yet, but they lost in court the last round. And they have yet to announce their strategy. But it's the same thing.
Hmm.
We have an agreement. We lived up to it. You guys saw a chance to make money doing something else. And you completely ignored the compact, which is like a treaty. And if you know anything about American Indian law and American Indian history, treaty violation is really sensitive in Indian country.
Interesting. Ken, hang on just a second. This is fascinating stuff. I got to take a quick break here. Don't go anywhere. Our guest with, again, a fascinating look at this whole thing is Ken Adams. Ken, hang on. Ken is a senior analyst at CDC GamingReports.com. More with Ken on what may lay ahead or may not or may have to wait a while again on legal sports gambling in Connecticut right after traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And I'm sure there are people in Norwalk, Fairfield County going, hey, what is up with the legal sports gambling thing here in the state? Let's get it going. Wait, didn't we have a deal a couple of weeks ago? Well, then 2 days later, we didn't. One tribe is on board, one is not. Talking about that and what he sees in the future, perhaps. Senior analyst Ken Adams, name of the website, cdcgamingreports.com, cdcgamingreports.com. Hey, Ken, let's assume for a second, I know that's dangerous, but let's assume that there is finally they get the Mashantucket Pequots to the table, the rounding error, the numbers are better, and we move forward here. Ken, if you were talking right now to members of the General Assembly, to the governor's task force, to him, maybe even to some of the tribal members, Ken, what would you tell them, in your opinion, that you've seen around the country, some to-dos and some maybe not-to-dos in the realm of bringing Connecticut into sports gambling and iGaming?
The to-dos would be to look around for states that are successful and use that model in the regulatory sense and as well as in a regulatory sense.
Mm-hmm.
The most important one right now is mobile betting. The states that have mobile betting, it's 80, 90, 95% of the total amount wagered.
Wow.
And the numbers are huge. They really, really, that's the most significant thing you can do if you want it to be successful. And then if you're looking for tax money, of course, it increases the tax money. In the lottery's case, they wouldn't be paying tax, I assume. They would merely be using it for whatever purposes the lottery was designed.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Other than that, if you just look at what other people are doing and model it on that, because they, at this point, the regulations are pretty well studied. And there are enough, there's about 22 states, I think, that are operating today, some sort of, mm-hmm. there's enough, the regulatory structure is there enough to tell you what's working and what's not. And I just say, pay attention.
Hey, Ken, off the top of your head, though, do one or two states immediately come to mind where you would say, hey, they do it really well, state A or state B? Do you have an example or two or not?
Pennsylvania, New Jersey. Well, New Jersey first.
Mm-hmm.
New Jersey is writing about $1 billion a month.
Jeez.
In sports wagering right now.
Mm.
They've been over 900 million and close to a billion for 3 months in a row. So that they obviously are doing it well. Then the next two states in volume are Nevada and Pennsylvania. Mm. So you'd say Pennsylvania is one. Then third on the list, they don't stay up with their reporting. They're a month behind, is Illinois, Indiana, and Colorado. Those states are booking a lot of bets.
Interesting.
Now, you have to win before you get any tax money, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't tax the wagers, you tax the net win. And the net win is usually somewhere in the neighborhood of between 7 and 10%. So that's what you can tax. And if you tax that too much, you discourage investment. So that's another place to be careful, is how much what your expectation is for the taxes.
So in other words,
not as much as you think.
So in other words, yeah, and I've heard that from some legislators, and they've told that to me, Ken, that, you know, we're only going to be able to get tax. And I think one of the people I had on said, you know, with the height, maybe 10% or so. So people shouldn't get bowled over, you're saying, by the numbers of a total handle, is what you're saying. That's not the bullseye here.
The handle is amount. So in New Jersey's case, I'm trying to remember now, it was 950 million, let's say, last month, and their win was about 80 million. So if you say 10% of that, right? That's, and 10% is a pretty high one, because they still have to operate everything, although
sure,
if it's all online, it's a lot cheaper. That's still, so you've got $8 million. So that the billion sounds like a bit, but the amount that the state has access to, that eight million, is not life-changing.
No, especially the way we spend.
Life-changing for you and I, but it's not life-changing for the state.
Well,
it's not life-changing for the tribes.
Operating a state. Ken, thank you. This has been fascinating. He's the senior analyst at CDCGamingReports.com. Check it out. I subscribed a long time ago, and I get them every day, and I read them. Fascinating stuff. CDCGamingReports.com. Good enough to join us from Reno, Nevada. Ken Adams. Ken, thank you. Hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you, Ken.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Ken, thank you. There you go, folks. CDCGamingReports.com. So understand it, and now I kind of understand it a little better, right? What did he say? You're only going to be able to tax 10% of the total handle. In other words, the return ratio on whatever the handle is. What do you say? In Jersey, it's a billion a month, but they're only paying out, say, you know, 80 or 90 million in winnings. So the winnings get taxed. Getting Their column and more for Hearst Connecticut Media. He's here to talk about his upcoming column and something coming up tonight. Jim Cameron is with us. Mr. Cameron, good evening. How are you, sir?
Dr. Pacelli, how are you, sir?
Yes, I got that doctorate from Cheerios University.
An honorary doctorate in ranting, I believe, is the description.
I sent in enough box tops. So anyway, before we get to your column, and I smiled and chuckled at a couple of things in your column about what people want, what is actually coming up tonight starting at 7 o'clock?
Well, I've been invited by the good folks at the Weston Public Library to do my virtual talk, which is called Off the Rails, the Future of Connecticut's Transportation Network After COVID. So if you'd like to hear more glum news about what the future is on the roads and rails, just go to Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N, Weston Public Library, and you can register and join us.
All right. Once again, folks, if you want to take part in that and watch what Jim has to say, Weston Public Library, find out in your Google or however you search the web, and click on the link, and you can hook up starting at 7 p.m. tonight. Now let's go, Jim, to your upcoming column here, which is How to Save Metro North. That's kind of a That's a big load there, Mr. Cameron. I read that and went, whoa. And talk a little about that, please.
Well, you know, I've been writing a lot about what's going to happen after COVID and predicting stuff that the railroad doesn't want to hear, which is, I don't think commuters are coming back in the big numbers that they used to. And they're all happy now because this new stimulus bill that's coming through Congress is going to send $6 billion, with a B, billion dollars to the MTA in New York. That's the parent of Metro North. So they're kind of going, okay, we made it through the year. We're not going to, you know, have to shut things down. But, you know, my question is, what's it going to take to get commuters to go back on the trains? So rather than just offering my opinions, I thought I would crowdsource this idea. So I posed that question on Facebook and on Twitter, and I asked commuters to chime in with their ideas. And they came up with a lot of ideas they said might incentivize them to get back on the train.
You know, Jim, a couple of the ones that caught my eye, one was, and I gave a big thumbs up to myself when I read this, was kind of zone service or deciding to cut down on some stops at certain times of the day to eliminate overcrowding and also to pick up the service times and speeds a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, the trains are running slower, and they have been for many years since that Fairfield derailment. But, you know, compounding the slowness of the train is how many stops the train makes. I mean, the trains from New York going to New Haven run express to Stamford, and then they usually make every single stop all the way to New Haven. So CONDOT has actually, you know, my sources inside the DOT have told me they're actually thinking about coming up with a zoned service. So your train will run nonstop from Grand Central to Stamford, and maybe the next stop will be Bridgeport. And they'll make a couple of stops after that. Or maybe they'll run as far as Fairfield and start stopping that, you know, stations after that. That will make the ride a little bit faster. But, you know, every bit counts. The biggest single idea that people had for encouraging people back onto the trains was speed, speed, and more speed.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Jim, prior to COVID-19, I was hitting the city two or three times a week, and sometimes I'm like, oh, please, there's got to be a better way. So what you're saying is we would have almost a reverse of the situation we have where you have to detrain and change if you're heading into New York, but you want to do any of those Westchester County stops. So they're essentially considering that in the opposite direction is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to a place between New York City and Stamford, you're probably going to have to change trains or take a local. Mm-hmm. But if you're going as far as, you know, let's take the worst, best case example. Let's say you're going to New Haven, New York. Wouldn't it be sweet if your train made one or two stops instead of 12 or 13 stops all the way up there? You could save considerable amounts of time. Yeah. Now, that means probably more trains going to fewer destinations with fewer cars, but the railroad thinks they can do that. They can zone that. I spent my teenage years in Westchester County on the Hudson River, and they had that zone service then when New York Central was running the trains. So it's absolutely doable. I mean, there are other things that people wanted as well, too. One person said, let's get reserved seats.
Yeah.
No standees. You know, how about Wi-Fi on the car, on the train, and bar cars?
I know.
Everybody wants the bar cars.
Yeah, because, Jim, that's exactly what we need, is people getting off the trains, right, and going to their cars.
Right off the trains.
Oh.
Sure. Absolutely.
Oh,
yep.
My God. Yep.
I don't think the bar cars are coming back, and I don't think Wi-Fi is. But lower fares, flexibility on the tickets. You know, one person even said, how about buy one, get one free weekend fare?
Yeah.
You know? And maybe free hats and noisemakers for everybody on Fridays.
I remember, Jim, I was heading into the city once, and there was a gentleman with his family there, and they were obviously tourists, and they boarded somewhere in Fairfield County. And I remember him pulling one of the conductors aside. I think it was a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, and he asked if there was any. He asked very, very, very properly in what sounded like a British accent, Are there any refreshments on the train? And we all went, well, we said, no, no.
No.
You're fending for yourself, pal. All right, so tonight, virtual talk, 7 p.m., folks. If you want to listen to what Jim has to say, Weston Public Library, go to their link, and then you can register for Jim tonight at 7. Think about that, folks. Have a nice bottle of Chianti with you or a nice little bottle of rosé. And you could
own bar card.
Yeah,
at home,
that's right. Jim Cameron, Jim, thanks. As always, good luck. We'll talk.
Thanks, Paul. Be well.
Thanks. Thanks. Appreciate that, Jim Cameron, folks. So tonight, in about an hour and 45 minutes, 7 o'clock, he's going to give a virtual talk, Connecticut's Transportation Future After COVID-19. It's sponsored by the Weston Public Library, so go online, get the link to the Weston Public Library, and they will have a link there where you can click on, and 7 o'clock, Mr. Cameron will come on, and he will give you his thoughts as to the future of transportation after COVID, and in particular, as thousands of us were doing pre-COVID, when it got really ugly, taking Metro North into and out of New York City multiple times a week. Melissa's here on WICC. Melissa, how are you?
I'm good. I enjoy listening to you. How are you?
Good. By the way, you and my producer are kind of jumping ugly here on Facebook. What's up with
he's
that?
He's annoying me. He's absolutely annoying the peanuts out of me. He's driving me crazy because he has this crazy theory. He just likes to get under my skin, and he's doing a really good job. He likes to randomly, he'll do this sometimes, and Stosh knows he does this. He'll, like, post something, and he'll be like,
wait for Melissa.
I don't know if anybody needs this right now. Like, I don't know if anyone wants to hear this right now. I don't know if anyone could, like, benefit from this. And then he'll throw out some really, like, I'm going to call it dumb comment that he knows is going to make everyone mad. He knows. If I had a little soundboard here, Sasha, what I would say to you, but I don't. But he's like, oh.
Yeah. Well,
He's like, everyone, just so you know, Universal's better than Disney. And it's like, go pound sand where you dropped on your head as a child.
Wow.
Good Lord.
Whoa.
Wow.
You're throwing, in hockey parlance, you're throwing haymaker punches at him. Wow.
I mean, it's like somebody saying to you, Paul, that your couch is not okay, that your home is not a safe place.
Okay.
I mean, Disney is literally like
okay.
my mecca.
Okay.
How dare you?
Okay. Breathe deeply. Okay.
Oh, if only I had a soundboard.
Okay. As far as the show tomorrow morning, what would we have? Yes.
So let me think. Tomorrow's a Wednesday.
Yes. I know you're shook up.
Tomorrow's a Wednesday. Look, Stosh has me all over the place. I told you this. You started this. Actually, you're an instigator. You started
no,
this.
No, I,
this
come up. On. Me? Me?
Come on. Stop. You all have so much fun in the afternoons. My gosh. Okay. Tomorrow we have Science You May Not Know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also excited. I don't know if you saw Milford released a new promotional video for shopping local and supporting small businesses.
Check that out.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. I posted it to my Facebook page, and I'm excited that Mayor Ben Blake is checking in tomorrow because – you know, I think a lot of people, Paul, feel like we're on the other end of this thing. We're getting to a point where we're going to open up restrictions, and that's great. But I think there's a big fear, which I'm going to talk to Mayor Blake about. I think there's a big fear that once everything kind of goes back to normal, everyone's going to kind of forget that. It's going to take us a good year, two years, three years to rebuild up our small businesses.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think this was a push for that and kind of talking about why now, like why highlight your businesses now a year after the pandemic got started. So I'm excited about that.
Okay.
And I'm sure I have a bunch of other people on as well.
But you're
on my little board in that room.
But you're a little shaken up now over this, so we'll let you go. Okay.
Well, you know, I'm trying to make chicken nuggets. I've got your producer who's harassing me when I've already been up since 2:30 in the morning.
Okay.
You know, like I have the I have things stacked against me,
you
Paul.
Do.
I don't
you
know
do.
If you realize
you
that.
Do. No, I do. I do. Listen, Melissa in the Morning tomorrow starting at 5 right here on WICC. Bye, Melissa. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, guys. Have fun.
Bye. See you later. All right. Boy, the and that's what my producer will do. Eric, you see, in hockey parlance, what Eric likes to do is Eric likes to, and this is kind of a hot, and guys and gals who play the game, who referee the game, who broadcast the game, we all know what this is. There's a thing in hockey parlance called chirping. And after the whistle goes and the referees have gotten in the middle and say, all right, boys, all right, ladies, let's go, move, let's go. There's that little things are said. And then, oh, but I can't get at you because the refs are telling me to skate away or I'm going to be in the box. So Eric's good. Great producer. Likes to chirp, though.